JB had heard the sound and immediately stopped. He had been walking at good speed, confident from the dull taste of the air that nobody had been in that section of the complex for many, many years.
Dark night!
But now, he had no doubt at all that someone else was inside the redoubt with him. Mildred recovered consciousness, feeling as though she were suffering from the worst migraine in the history of the universe. There was a whole mess of things that she couldn't stand about living in the Deathlands, but the sickening horror of making a Matrance jump was among the worst. She sat up very slowly, holding her head in both hands, not yet willing to open her eyes. When Mildred eventually did, the flaming brightness of the cherry-red armor-glass walls of the chamber almost made her pass out again. The chemical smell grew stronger as the elevator climbed the endless shaft. Ryan waited patiently, trying to work out the speed he was traveling at, and hence the depth of the Matran section of the redoubt. But it was impossible to judge. All he could tell for sure was that it was seriously deep. The upward movement slowed, and then ceased. Ryan's finger hesitated over the button that would open the sliding steel door. He ran his mind over the code in case he needed to get back quickly to the gateway. In case he needed to get back to the gateway at all. The overwhelming probability was that he would never be able to return if he forgot the comp sequence.
Green CM 19 blue 5 E red.
Numbers had never been Ryan's strong point. Trader, even though he was nearly illiterate, was able to reel off strings of map coordinates or quote endless details of muzzle velocities or the populations and sex strength of dozens of vills throughout the Deathlands. Here, at the top of the shaft, the air seemed a little fresher, though it also carried a stronger taint of the medical smells. Ryan couldn't believe that the place was still working as a hospital. During his travels with Warwags 1 and 2, he would surely have heard something about such a place. But he gripped his blaster more tightly, eased the shoulder strap on the Steyr rifle, and pressed the button. JB saw the elevator, with the light showing that it was at the top. He also spotted the code written out on the wall alongside the control panel. He moved in closer and waited.
Ah, fire blast.
The impenetrable sec door slid open, and the elevator cage was flooded with the hospital smell, so strong and sickly that it made Ryan gag. It was overlaid with more familiar scents, the sweetness of decay, and the unforgettable gut-churning odor of much dying. He wished profoundly that he had JB on his right hand to face whatever it was that lay out there. Perhaps whatever it was might walk alone. There was an open area immediately in front of him, with a number of other passages leading off it. Ryan saw there was a large wall plan of the redoubt opposite, but it had been daubed with what could have been paint, tar, or old dried blood. Whatever it was, had completely obscured the map. The floor outside the elevator was in stark contrast to that around the gateway. It was muddy and scuffed, showing the blurred marks of dozens of feet. As Ryan stepped out of the cage with infinite caution, he saw that the walls on either side of it had been hacked and scarred, the reinforced concrete gouged, and the vanadium steel of the door itself and its surround showing innumerable bright scratches. But there were no marks of gunfire. No evidence that anyone had tried to use a Gren to break into the elevator and get down to the Matran section. The damage looked like it had been done with nothing more lethal than knives or chisels. The control panel had also been attacked, but the cover was sheet armaglass and had hardly been touched. Ryan pressed his finger to the contact pad marked door close and stood back, mentally rehearsing the control code to himself. The steel slid silently across, the light above it showing that the elevator was at the top. Since there was no visible sign of life, Ryan obeyed one of the trader's cardinal rules and stood still for several seconds, listening. He could feel a draft on his stubbled cheek and half turned to face it. Apart from the vile stench it carried, he could actually detect what might be fresh air. It wasn't by any means certain, but Ryan was beginning to think that the redoubt had probably been penetrated. There didn't seem to be any distinguishable noise coming from any of the corridors. The two simple choices were to either explore as much as possible of the military complex and see if there was anything worth the taking, or to simply head for the nearest exit and get into the open. Partly because of the smell, Ryan's heart inclined toward the latter option. But his head guided him toward a wreck of the redoubt first. Since the wide passageway immediately ahead of him brought the wind, and also seemed to have been most used, he decided to try it first. As he walked away from the elevator, Ryan's boots scraped on the pebbles and mud, drowning the tiny sound from inside the cage. If he turned around at that moment, he would have seen that the light had vanished from the letter T, and would in a couple of minutes glow once more behind the letter B. JB stood patiently at the bottom of the shaft, awaiting the arrival of the elevator. Years of painfully learned caution made him turn to check the corridor behind him, but there was no sight or sound of any living thing anywhere near. Mildred had managed to get out of the chamber without throwing up, and was now sitting in front of a comp console at one of the desks in the large room. While she sat there, Mildred started to doodle on the keys, watching as the white letters appeared dutifully across the bright blue screen.
My name is Mildred Winonia Wyeth, and I was born on the 17th day of December. Oh, shit. December 1964. That's more than 100 years ago. I'm a qualified doctor of medicine specializing in freezing techniques of human tissue. Ironic, considering that's what happened to me 11 days after my 36th birthday. I got frozen. My father was a Baptist minister, murdered by the white sheet cowardly bastards of the invisible empire of the Klan only a year after I was born. My father's brother, Josh, helped.
She stopped, feeling the short hairs prickling at her nape, and she turned in the revolving chair. Through the anteroom, Mildred watched as the main armor-glass door of the gateway chamber began silently to close.
Holy!
She jumped to her feet and raced toward the exit doors, reaching out for the green lever, not bothering in her panic to check for safety. She plunged under the rising mass of steel as soon as it was high enough and immediately reversed the direction. She knelt on the other side, panting as if she'd run a half mile across a plowed field, the revolver in her hand. She could hear the recorded voice inside, shut off by the sectors.
Matter transfer in progress. Any personnel with a sec rating below B19 must leave.
The clock on the wall showed precisely 08:59. Christy Roth and Dean Cotter were just completing their second jump. Out in the corridor, Mildred was more aware of the odd smell in the redoubt.
Formaldehyde? Can't be. Surgical disinfectant and some kind of gangrene.
The mix of medical sense was puzzling. To her left, the corridor ended in a totally blank wall, blocking off any thought of progress in that direction. The other way was a winding, well-lit passage, like ones that she'd seen in other redoubts. Mildred noticed that the ceiling was dotted with miniature surveillance cameras, reminding her of visits to the shopping mall in Lincoln, Nebraska. She held her ZKR 551 in her right hand.
Here goes nothing.
JB would never have admitted it to anyone, not even Ryan or Mildred, that he suffered from claustrophobia, but the truth was that he found any confined space extremely difficult to handle. It dated back many years before he met the traitor and Ryan Cotter. He'd been born in Cripple Creek in Colorado, a beautiful town that had boomed during the 90s with the legalization of gambling in the old mining township, a boom that was predictably followed by a bust not long before Skydark, when that same legislation was repealed. The hills around the township were littered with hundreds of old mine shafts. Since the long winters, many had been used by the ragtag collection of Rad 6 survivors, countless numbers of them dying in those cold, barren caverns. The young John Dix had been a great explorer, preferring his own company to that of the teenaged gangs around Cripple Creek. He knew that some of the mummified corpses in the tunnels had died with blasters in their possession. Even at the age of 10, JB had been fascinated by weaponry. He'd taken to roaming for days on end, living off the land, exploring the more isolated diggings. It had been called the Lucky Chance Mine. Boards across its entrance had been pulled down for burning, and the entire site had almost vanished under a rock slide. but there was a gap just big enough for a skinny little boy to wriggle through, his pocket oil lamp primed and ready. At first it had looked like it was a deuce on the line, no signs of human habitation. JB had persevered and gone deeper into the winding passage. At first he thought he was imagining it, holding the light higher so that its flickering golden glow reached into the deeper shadows. A cabin was built within the mine. Using the old props and timbers, the rickety roof actually held up the roof of the mine. As the boy had walked closer, the echo of his feet brought down a fine dust from the curved ceiling, a sure sign of serious danger of collapse. There was a glider on the porch, its swing long rusted through. A dried corpse lay among the tattered rags of a blanket. JB had looked at it from a few yards off, seeing, to his disappointment, that there was no blaster around. Moving as if he were treading on eggshells, he'd picked his way past the body, the lantern ahead of him, into the ramshackle hut, aware that even his lightweight was making beams shift a little, creaking in protest, like a sleeper being pulled back to the light of morning. There was a table with a couple of plates on it, both covered in a sheen of gray dust, a collapsed armchair and a fireplace, soot-blackened and empty, half a dozen empty bottles and a few cans, still silver bright in the dry atmosphere. There was a double bunk bed in the far corner. As the lad had stepped across toward it, he felt the floorboard shift. But he'd seen the gun, glittering like a jewel in a pirate's den. He'd recognized it immediately as a chromed Colt Cobra 1973, a six-round double-action revolver that fired a solid .38 caliber round. It had a snub-nosed two-inch barrel, and JB reckoned he could get a handful of jack for it at the general trading store. There was a bundle shape on the top bunk that he figured might well be the partner of the corpse out on the porch. Likely, they'd both starved to death or succumbed to the long-term effects of rad sickness. He'd seen enough of that himself in the previous few years, hair loss and bleeding gums, and sores that spread to cover most of a person's emaciated body. He had moved like a frail ghost, setting one foot slowly down in front of the other, trying to ignore the ominous sounds of straining timbers and the fine dust that floated around the sheltered flame of the oil lamp. As the boy knelt to pick up the gun, his hand brushing the checkered grips, the cabin collapsed. For a few moments, the shock robbed him of his senses, but when he opened his eyes, he realized that the lamp was, amazingly, still lit at his side, and that the body from the bunk now lay above him, pinning him to the floor in its dry embrace. The skull face was inches from his. The mane of long, brittle golden hair that caressed JB's cheeks told him the corpse had been female. The eyes had long vanished into the smeared sockets, and the skin of the cheeks had shrunk and tightened across the planes of bone. The lipless mouth was wide open, the irregular yellow teeth actually nipping at his own skin below his left eye. JB's arms and legs were pinned by the tumbled hut and the heaped rocks, the skeletal figure in the torn shreds of a plaid shirt hugging him in a ghastly parody of a lover's embrace. It took perhaps the greatest effort of will for JB to ever reassert self-control. Faced with his ultimate horror, the lamp beginning to gutter and die, virtually anyone, man, woman, or child, would have given in to insanity and despair. Not John Barrymore Dix. He closed his eyes and breathed slow and thought about the rolling mountains and the sunlight and fresh snow and crystal streams and live oaks in the spring and the shivering aspens in the fall. He also mentally rehearsed some of the encyclopedia of arcane blaster knowledge that he already possessed, gleaned from some old gun books he'd found.
200 yards of 577 rifled musket ball with standard charge will penetrate seasoned white pine to a depth of 11 inches. A 69 caliber smoothbore to half an inch less. A 58 rifle to just over 9 inches. And a 58 pistol carbine to below 6 inches.
Gradually, the lad's heart stopped pounding like a miniature trip hammer in his scrawny chest. He was able to consider his position with a careful objectivity, trying to move first each foot and then each hand, working out what was holding him down and precisely where his best option for escape lay. The light was close to being done, and he knew that he had to get free before that happened. The idea of being held forever under the leering skull in total darkness was so appalling that JB consciously thrust it away from him. His left leg moved most, and the boy concentrated all of his attention on that, wriggling and pulling, trying to ignore the suspicion that the whole mountain was poised above him, ready to tumble and blur him into infinity. Something slid away, and the leg was free. JB brought it up and used it to push at the part of the bed frame that was trapping his left arm. He was caught near the wrist, and he tugged, feeling skin tear and warm blood flowing over his fingers. It was moving. By turning half on his side, he could lever his right arm out, finally flailing away at the brittle corpse, a moment of panic returning as the jagged teeth clamped on a fold of skin at the front of his throat. He could never quite remember how he got his other leg free, or how he made his way in the utter velvet blackness after the tiny flame died, to fresh air and safety. And ever after, J.B. Dix had been unhappy in confined spaces. Spaces like the cage of the waiting elevator. But he did eventually manage to get a good handful of jack from the sour-faced storekeeper in Cripple Creek for the chromed Colt Cobra. Dean Cotter was parchment pale, and threads of vomit dappled the front of his black denim jacket. He looked at the gateway, where Christy Roth stood staring at the labeling on the piled boxes.
Yeah. I think that means we could be somewhere farther west than we were in the Keys.
Christy's hair was almost dry, but it still clung to her skull like a small, fiery animal. She was recovering from the second jump, feeling surprisingly well, though there was a nagging worry at the back of her mind. Something wasn't right about this gateway, but she couldn't put her finger on what that was. The air smelled strange.
Where's Dad?
I don't know, Dean.
He is here, isn't he?
Christy really hadn't thought about that possibility. After the last jump and the horrific experience of finding that she and the boy were all alone, it hadn't occurred to her that Ryan, or any of the others, could be here. After the last jump and the horrific experience of finding that she and the boy were all alone, it hadn't occurred to her that Ryan, or any of the others, could be here.
No way of knowing.
He might come through, or he might have gotten here before we did.
Christy shook her head doubtfully.
We don't know how many redoubts like this were built, Dean. I've lost count of the ones I've visited, a couple of dozen easily. And loads more must have been destroyed by the nuking.
But they're mostly well hid. They reckon they was a hot pipe to survive.
Were.
Christy managed to smile.
Like father, like son, Dean. You should say they were and not they was, that's all. But yeah, it's true. They picked mainly isolated places for the redoubts and buried them deep. I suppose it's a remote statistical chance that Ryan or one of the others might have ended up in the same one as we have.
Let's go look!
The clock showed 0914.
Hey, wait up. Don't touch that control lever. Not yet.
Dean started to run up and down the aisles of desks, punching his fist in the air, brimming with excitement at the chance of being reunited with his father.
Cool it down. Odds are dozens to one. No, they could be hundreds to one.
She noticed that the curly-haired boy had skidded to a halt, retracing his steps and stopping in front of one of the screens.
What is it?
Hundreds to one? I don't think so.
What's there, Dean? Is that a message from Ryan?
No, but come and look!
Christy walked over to the comp screen Dean had indicated.
My name is Wildred Winonia Wyeth, and...
The message ended abruptly a few lines later, like someone had crept up behind Mildred and plunged a knife through her heart. But somehow Christy didn't get the feeling that anything bad had happened to their friend, just that she'd been interrupted while leaving word to anyone coming along later.
How long ago?
Can't tell.
Christy looked at the keyboard, wondering if it could magically give a clue about the time that the message had been typed.
If Mildred got through here...
Dean allowed the hopeful sentence to trail away.
And maybe... Maybe Ryan could also be in this redoubt.
Another thought came to her.
Or he might still be making a jump here.
Behind Christy, the cherry red chamber door whispered shut.
Matter transfer in progress. Any personnel with a security rating below B-19 must leave immediately. Repeat, immediately. Matter transfer in progress.
Christy drew the Smith & Wesson 640, conscious that the boy had pulled out his Browning high power. They waited together.